This podcast is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity, like Progressive home and auto policies. They're best when bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How are you doing? Tell me about your last 24 hours.
I mean, I'm exhausted. I got about 6 hours of sleep. I just came from trying to squeeze in my department's senior thesis presentations. And I'm furious. I mean, I'm absolutely furious.
This is Joe Howley. He's a professor at Columbia University, teaches classics. And when the NYPD stomped onto campus earlier this week to kick protesters out of a building they'd occupied, they stomped right into Joe's office.
You know, I walked past the other day and I saw a banner hanging out, and I thought, oh, well, I'm glad that's not hanging out of my office window, because I really left my office a mess. I'm just grateful I brought my laptop home that the night before.
Joe's always known that the place he works, Hamilton Hall, has got a history. Students occupied it in 1968 to protest the Vietnam War, then again in 1985 to protest apartheid in South Africa. Joe says he did not know this year's occupation of Hamilton Hall was coming, but he and a few other faculty members who were advising the student protesters, they knew how agitated they were all getting.
We tell them what we think. And, you know, certainly I think I'm not the only one who in recent weeks had a student say to me something like, well, we could always escalate. And I've always said, please do not escalate. That would be a really stupid thing to do.
When did it become clear that the police were going to be called in to get students out of Hamilton Hall?
I mean, I assumed that that was in the cards as soon as I saw that it had happened. On Monday, the university escalated with the students. They issued really punitive disciplinary threats. They were really aggressive about it. Then they started seeing students, including students who were nowhere near the camp. I know students who were nowhere near the encampment at the deadline, but have Palestinian last names, and they've gotten suspension notices. So clearly the university is just going cowboy with the discipline here. And it is amazing to me that this building was left unsecured overnight. It's like no one running the university has read a book about the history of protest movements on campuses, or this campus in particular, which is really wild because it's very obvious that our students have.
Joe says he actually wanted to prevent the police from having to go in at all.
I spent most of the day working with a group of faculty members who we thought could have the trust of the students, faculty members who were former protesters in the 80s and 90s here themselves. And offering to the university leadership through the university senate to say, look, if you can let us back onto campus, we can reach out to these students and try to build a bridge and open a dialogue and try to defuse this situation. And we were just rebuffed and ignored by university leadership.
This is when everything went down. First, a ton of cops showed up. Then they backed up a little ramp to Joe's office building and started hauling folks out. The whole time, Joe was listening to the college radio station, which was broadcasting live.
You know, listening to our student journalists as riot police, you know, took apart the building where I work, dragged students out, and then hearing from colleagues this morning about the students coming out of one police plaza with lacerations and bruises, you know, from being kicked down the stairs, injuries that look like they were sustained after they were already zip tied in police custody, you know, every single thing about this is completely maddening, and none of it had to happen.
I'm struck by the fact that basically at the same time, the cops were coming onto Columbia's campus, kicking protesters out of Hamilton Hall. A really different situation was playing out at UCLA. There, law enforcement was nowhere to be seen as pro-Israel counter-protesters moved in on a pro-Palestinian encampment.
I mean, so many universities telegraphed across this country that maximum police force is a viable response to these protests. I am not surprised that vigilante mob violence broke out.
Today on the show, a professor's year alongside the protesters. It changed him. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. So, Joe, how did you get involved in the campus protests at Columbia? Like, I heard that even before the encampment started, you know, you were getting together with other Jewish faculty to write letters to the college president, all sorts of things like that. Why were you getting involved in these ways?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much not typical for me. You know, in October, in the weeks after October 7th, I was getting messages from the instructors I supervise. Their students were coming and talking to them because they were reading like Aeschylus's Oresteia or the Book of Job. And the students wanted to connect these themes of retributive violence and justice to what was happening in the news in the middle of October. And the instructors were saying, I don't know how to have this conversation. I don't know if it's safe to talk about the war in the classroom. And I wrote them this long memo and I said, look, first of all, it's already clear to me in October that I'm not sure I can protect you if this gets, you know, really McCarthyite.
Wow, you said that back then.
I said that back then, yeah. And I thought I was being paranoid, but now I don't think that. I say this having taught through, you know, the Trump years and Black Lives Matter, that if you, as an educator, if you feel the urge to say or do something politically, you know, I really urged them to find the other venues for their politics and activism because I didn't want them to get in trouble. And I also didn't want them to kind of transgress in that way and damage the relationship with their students. And I'm saying that to try to demonstrate to you how out of kind of character this is for me. So here's what happened in the fall, not long after the really terrible attacks on October 7th. Some anti-war student groups put out a statement in which they urged everyone in the community to think about these attacks in context of history, you know, in the context of what had already happened that year, right? So by October 6, 2023, there were like unprecedented levels of violence in the West Bank. It was the deadliest year on record for Palestinian children. So the student groups were trying to talk about this stuff in context. And we have, you know, longstanding tradition of anti-war and anti-occupation student activists on this campus. And after the student groups issued this statement, people all over the country started attacking them for being anti-Semitic. And a couple of really brave and principled colleagues put together an open letter to defend our students from these charges. And this letter said, look, we as faculty don't agree with everything our students have said necessarily, but we support their right to say it. Okay, so I signed that letter. Then several faculty members who have a track record of being really outspoken in attacking critics of Israel on our campus published a different open letter, basically attacking all of us, the students who issued the statement, the faculty who signed the first letter.
This sounds like a nightmare.
As soon as they issued that second letter calling us all out, I started getting harassing emails from strangers. And then one day I got an email from a senior colleague, a senior Jewish colleague who had formerly been a high-level administrator. I had worked with them when they were administrator. It was a personal note to me, chastising me for signing the open letter, and basically saying all the same stuff that the crazy internet trolls were saying, but in much more genteel terms. You know, like, how dare you defend the students talking about the October 7th attacks as a military operation rather than an atrocity, this kind of thing. And I was totally bowled over. And I started thinking, well, you know what? I've got tenure. I mean, maybe I need to be speaking up.
How did you hear the students were going to be setting up an encampment?
I didn't. I woke up and my phone was full of pictures of this encampment. And that was the day that university leadership was in front of Congress.
What'd you think?
Well, I thought, you know, probably could have seen this coming.
Did it feel necessary at that point?
You know, something that I think is really important is there's a real way in which I don't trust my instincts about what is necessary for student activists to do. Because I am, you know, I am overly protective of them, kind of like with kids, right? And as a faculty member, I am an institutionalist, inevitably, to some degree, right? So like stuff that interferes with the operation of the institution, I'm inevitably going to have reservations about, you know? And so I really do believe that the students have different instincts about things like political and moral urgency. And as a professor, I think I have a responsibility to respect the difference in those instincts.
How did things inside the encampment change as the protests at Columbia got more media and political attention? Like initially, the encampment was there for a couple of days. The cops came. They broke it down. It sprung up almost immediately again.
Yeah. The first encampment, which went up while our university leadership was in D.C., was up for about 36 hours. University leaders called in the cops before they'd even gotten back from D.C. And that was a small, very organized, very focused encampment. You know, while the cops were still pouring out their coffee on the one lawn, another group of students set up a second encampment, and it was immediately clear that it was much bigger. It was more diverse. Students had really been energized by the first one and by the police repression. That police repression turned up the temperature in all sorts of really unhelpful ways. We had all these solidarity protests outside the gates. They became a kind of a media spectacle. And I could see the encampment get more organized, more disciplined.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time this is happening, there are negotiations, right, between the protesters and the university?
I'm going to choose my words carefully here. It has not been my experience that when the university negotiates with student activists, that they do so with excessive good faith. It has been my experience that when the university negotiates with student activists, they by and large treat the students with contempt and only take them seriously when they are forced to. You know, what happened in recent days is that the university made a so-called final offer. The students balked at it because it was not a great offer. The university then made a real final offer that was worse, somehow expecting the students to take that. And then the university pulled the plug on negotiations. And I think that was, you know, that was the state of play by Sunday night.
Yeah, you said that a senior figure involved in negotiations reported that students asked for 30 minutes to consider a deal that the university had put forward, and they were refused.
That's what we heard yesterday as the cops were massing on Broadway in Amsterdam. Yeah. It's never been clear to me how genuinely interested the university was in negotiation. And it's never been clear to me in this whole process when the university says, either in private or in public, that certain things are not possible. Are they talking about not possible according to the laws of physics, or are they talking about not possible according to the political will of the trustees? Because those are two very different things.
We'll be back after a break.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Can we talk about the occupation of Hamilton Hall? Like, earlier this week, overnight, students barricaded themselves inside. It was definitely an escalation. Did you think about it as an appropriate form of protest? Or were you, was that like not even part of your thinking? You were just like, it's an obvious next step.
I have been very clear all through this with everyone I talk to that I don't think it's very useful for me to pass judgment on student protesters' tactics. When the students say and do things that I don't like personally, or that I feel uncomfortable with, or that I think are counterproductive, I will reach out to students I have good relationships with and say, you know, I wish you wouldn't do this chant or whatever. But I really value my ability to maintain relationships of trust with both university leaders and with the students. And one way I maintain those relationships is by not trying to make anyone do anything. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I share my opinion as a peer and I listen. You know, I thought that the occupation was incredibly dangerous. I thought it endangered all the students there. It endangered everyone on campus because police action was the obvious response. And it endangered the faculty observers who had no idea what was about to happen and were stuck on campus, essentially, in this scenario. And then also I thought, gosh, I shouldn't have left those French fries in my office trash can because I don't know when I'll get back in there to clear it out.
You know, the university said it had no choice but to call the police once the students took over a building. It sounds like you think it was an inevitable choice, but do you think they had no choice? Like, what if the president of Colombia came to the encampment, came to the building and said, all right, let's talk. Like, would that have worked?
We had members of Congress come to the encampment and talk to students, but we never saw the president of the university come down there and talk to them, you know, in the weeks before the building occupation. So, you know, I can only dream of what would have happened if anyone from the university side had really engaged in good faith. The university said they had no choice. Look, I understand the institutional logic there. I understand it's a fire hazard. I understand that they had a reasonably credible fear that there were off-campus folks maybe involved. I also think that people with a lot of power love to say they don't have any choice right before they do something really harmful. And I mean, I thank God every day I'm not running the university, but I would have liked to think that what we saw last night was not an option. I would have liked to think that every possible option would be exhausted before we would resort to something like that.
How has the last year fundamentally altered your relationship with the university?
You know, I have done every major service role in my department except chair. I have been on committees at every level of this university. I got tenure the year the pandemic started, and I spent a year that was supposed to be on sabbatical trying to get employment protections, tenure track protections for untenured faculty to mitigate the impact of the pandemic. I have given this institution so much service because I believe in it. I believe in my colleagues. And I think that that's what being a faculty member means. It means being a citizen and contributing and being involved. The university's handling of the crisis of the last 6 months, and particularly the last few weeks, has shaken my confidence in the institution to the core and has left real fissures in my ability to trust the university. I think I am not the only one right now asking myself, why do I work here? And what do I really owe this institution? You know, I have an important leadership role in our undergraduate curriculum right now. And I like and trust the dean that I work for. And I think of myself as working for him, as working for the students we teach, as working for the instructors that I supervise. But, having seen the way my colleagues have been treated over the last few months and the way our students have been treated, I just don't know who I'm working for anymore.
What happens now? I mean, we've talked about how there was a police response to the first encampment. It logically led to the next encampment, which was bigger. You've talked about how the occupation of Hamilton Hall was an escalation that you also thought was inevitable, given how the university was responding to the protesters. So what's the next inevitable escalation, or is there one? Like, are you thinking through that?
I mean, I don't know what happens with the protest movement. You know, if the students had walked away 3 days ago, I would have called it a victory. They ignited a national movement. They laid bare all the contradictions and BS from this institution about its priorities. I don't even know. I mean, we've got cops on campus for the next 3 weeks. I don't know. The express purpose of that is to have no more political activity on this campus until graduation is over. But look, it took years to get divestment from South Africa from when the students first started protesting, but they got it. And those moves take many different forms. And I think faculty understand now how involved we have to be. There's parts of this struggle on campus that really have to happen in faculty governance venues. you know, a week ago, I was telling people I was furious with how our university leaders handled Congress. I was furious with how they called the cops the first time. But I am not interested in calling for the president to resign, A, because I think leadership is a larger group of people than just the president, but B, because I'm not interested in our president losing her job in a context where the Chris Rufos and the Virginia Foxes of the world are actively trying to get women presidents of Ivy League universities fired, right? So I don't want to give them another notch on their belt, and I don't want to give them that power over the institution.
Yeah, Virginia Fox is a congresswoman, and Chris Rufos, the activist who ignited the firestorm against DEI.
Yeah. But look, Barnard College just had a historic, unprecedented vote of no confidence in their president. I mean, the Columbia University Senate passed a resolution basically condemning all the errors of our university leadership, but stopping short of censure or no confidence or anything like that. After the first police action and before the second police action. So I think maybe we see what happens when you pull your punches on expressing your disapproval.
So you're changing your mind.
It's not that I'm changing my mind. I still feel like I don't want these right-wing bad actors to be able to take credit for getting a president fired. But what I'm saying is that the faculty sentiment overall, it's the horses out of the barn. You know, like I have heard faculty today who I've never heard to talk about this stuff, talking about no confidence, talking about the president has to resign, talking about the whole board of trustees has to go.
Wow.
There is a real rift here. And like I said, this is a rift that opened in November, and every step since then has just widened it and widened it and widened it. And now we see where that gets us. It gets us to leadership with a kind of total lack of values or principles around what a university actually is. And it gets us, you know, hundreds of cops in riot gear kicking students down the stairs in the building where I work. So I truly don't know what happens next.
Are you going to graduation?
Well, for the past 2 weeks, university leaders have been winding themselves up to do what they did the other night by saying, we have to have a graduation. We have to have a normal graduation. This year's graduating class had their high school graduation disrupted by pandemic. They deserve a real graduation. And look, I'm not arguing with any student who wants to have a real in-person graduation. I think graduation is lovely. But are any of us going to feel like this is a normal graduation this year? You know, if we have graduation on campus this year, like we normally do, everyone sitting on the South Lawn West is going to be sitting on artificial floor laid over grass that right now is patterned with dozens of yellow rectangles from where the Gaza Solidarity encampment was. Everyone's going to be sitting there for graduation on the same lawn where peaceful student protesters were dragged out by riot cops last night while student journalists were locked in the journalism school under threat of arrest if they came out to document the scene. So, gosh, I guess I hope that feels normal to some people. I don't know what to say.
Joe Howley, I'm really grateful for your time.
Thanks for your interest.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Joe Howley is an associate professor in the Classics Department at Columbia University. And that is our show. If you're a fan of What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.